Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Streets Ahead, your podcast dedicated to all things cycling, walking and wheeling in the UK and beyond. I'm Ned Bolting.
I'm Adam Tranter.
And I'm Laura Laker.
It's easy as that, really, podcasting, isn't it? And this week we're discussing why Oxford is so popular for cycling. Is it something to do with the university? Is it an ingrained cycling culture? Is it because for decades they've filtered through traffic on minor roads? Is it because it costs 35 quid to park a car for 24 hours? In this episode, we'll be exploring Oxford's new low-traffic neighbourhoods and how they have struck a nerve, but we'll also look at older filters that are the staple of Oxford's cycling network and often go unnoticed. We'll also confront the slightly awkward truth that Oxford doesn't have very good cycle lanes and shows that perhaps they're not always needed. We'll talk to Councillor Emily Kerr, who will take us on a short tour of her neighbourhood. But before we even get to Oxford, Laura.
Yeah.
Let's start with Adam. Adam, because I know how Laura got here. Well, I know a bit of the story anyway. How did you get to Oxford, Adam? Did you drive? And have you parked your car for 35 quid?
No, and actually I have done that once years ago. And you know what? It really left an impression on me not to do it ever again.
Oh, really?
My little electric car, and I parked up, and it was 35 quid for the day. We were staying in a hotel, our kind of family getaway. And I saw this forum thread afterwards with Oxfordshire councillors talking about the parking policy and people saying you should make electric vehicle charging cheaper for people coming into the city to encourage it. And I'm like, no, you shouldn't. I'm an idiot. I drove here in the face of sustainable options. I'm taking up just as much of space as the next person.
Yep.
You should be charging me through the nose for this parking. And I'm grateful that you did. And I'm probably that's the only time everyone has ever said that to them. But yeah, so I drove in years ago and never did it again. So today I got the train from my local station to Coventry to Oxford. Split ticket, £24 return. It's not bad. Yeah,
that's pretty good, really.
And I've just been cycling around.
Funny, isn't it? There is this perception, which is partly true, I think, undeniably true, but only in part, that train travel in the UK is ludicrously overpriced, which is... I'm not denying it for a second, Laura. Some of it is, I mean, just mind-blowingly overpriced. It kind of, like, leaves you... But just recently, I've been messing around at the Commonwealth Games, and I've been kind of just coming and going to and from the line that you must take quite often, though. The Warwick to London line.
That's one of the ones I did today. Yeah,
it's a bus with a bus on tracks, isn't it? The whole thing rattles. But you know, it was like 30 quid return or something. I thought that was all right. I think it's okay. So I've taken the train along with Laura from Paddington up to Oxford and back again. 34 quid. I don't know what you paid.
20 because network rail card.
But 30. I mean, I think that's.
It's about not too right. Bad.
It's like maybe a little bit too, but yeah. I don't think it's unreasonable. I don't think it's unreasonable. It's an hour's ride, isn't it?
Yeah. Pretty good.
So anyway, I got the train, but you got the train. We've all got our bicycles here. That was a bit of a mission, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I realise actually you can book the bike space on the GWR app. You can just click how many bike spaces you want, and I have one ticket, so I got one bike space. And they don't charge you anything, actually. Usually I would do it through something like Trainline, and then you have to phone up. It's quite slow because then the person on the line has to put you on hold.
Other side of the world. They're the other side of the world.
Yeah,
as well,
I think they are. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, they have to put you on hold and then check for the spaces. And it is quite... I've booked a space last minute with my bike before and had to wait sort of on the platform for them to get my bike space and sort of crossing my fingers given I've just spent money on a ticket.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, it's the most ludicrous system that...
That's all well and good, but the cycle parking... Part of the issue is the booking and stuff, but the other issue is those GWR trains.
Cycle you have to, torture chamber.
You have to sort of lift your bike up onto like a little hook, don't you? And how are you going to do that if you've got an e-bike?
Yeah, I've got a little video actually of my bike just like being swacked against the side of the bike carriage. It's just dangling from its front wheel.
But meat hook style, like a carcass in the back of a refrigerated
truck. It's harsh, yeah.
But that's if you've got the strength to get it up there in the first place.
Yeah, it's awful. Yeah, I've got my pink e-bike there before and it's got really fat wheels and fat tyres because it's designed to be bashed around and I couldn't get it off. I think the feeling is that they just make it as difficult as possible to put you off travelling with a bike.
Yeah,
I think that's.
I don't know if that's true, but it does. That's how it feels.
It doesn't feel like that.
It doesn't really feel like you're incentivizing and encouraging.
And the train staff, actually, I was sort of panicking because I got to my station and I couldn't get the bike off, and the train manager guy said he wasn't allowed to help me in case.
What, just in Oxford?
They were told no on a previous journey. They've been told they're not allowed to help in case they
safety.
In case they break the bike and you sue them. Yeah, in case they break the bike wheel unhooking it. So, yeah, it's really.
Yeah.
Yeah. His feeling was that they make it deliberately difficult, and he was kind of on the borders of Wales and England, and he gets the sort of the other trains. Basically, he's got a different choice of train, so he just doesn't bother getting the GWRs. Yeah.
Well, we're here now.
Yeah,
we're here now. What do we're outside the Handlebar Cafe and
the
Kitchen. That's not a plug because we had to pay £4.75 for this cola. It's nice.
It's from Hamburg.
Yeah, we're in a little parklet. Actually, cool.
We are in a little parklet.
It's lovely.
Me and Laura in the shade, and Ned as a seasoned traveller is just burning in full sun.
That's the sound of me drinking the Coke.
But I'm sure he's used to it, being on his Tour de France escapades. Yeah. And I wanted to come to Oxford because, as I say, I came here with family, well, a month or so ago now, and I loved it. I just loved walking around, and I kind of felt this is what it's about. And several things came to my head about this. One is, there's this whole thing about the Conservative Party, you know, leadership election and the next Prime Minister. And there's a concern...
Is there? I hadn't noticed.
It's been stretched out. But all that aside, you've got two candidates that are both taught at Oxford. They both did their degrees at Oxford, as added many of the political class of all political colours. And we're getting a little street sweeper.
It's just an overheating mini.
Oh, right. Oh, God. That's probably a metaphor there, isn't there? Yeah. Sort of like a combustion engine car about to explode.
The fans just going
in the hot weather.
They're made here, aren't they, minis?
They are, yeah, they're made here.
There we go.
So we should be grateful
of
them. But no, the next Prime Minister will have been educated at Oxford.
Hmm.
But it's by no means a certain that the next Prime Minister will fully embrace active travel like Boris Johnson.
They probably cycled. Would they have cycled to uni,
well,
do you think?
Well, this is it. I think they must have. They must go, you know, you walk around here and you go, this is nice. And I wonder whether people think you can only do this because it's Oxford and it's slightly different. Because I look at it from a transport point of view, I'm like, well, all it is, it's filters, it's modal filters, it's bus gates, it's cycle lanes.
Yeah.
You can do that anywhere. And I think people think you can't do it just because it's Oxford. You know, that's different and new. But I think you could do this anywhere.
Yeah.
And I wonder whether, rather than having like mini Hollands, whether we should be selling mini Oxfords.
Mini Cambridges.
Yeah. I don't know. Just a thought out there. But anyway, I like
thought.
It here.
It's
and
a
I
good thought. Like I was looking at the stats for cycling levels. 40% of people in Oxford cycle at least once a week.
That's presumably hugely different from the rest of the country.
Cambridge is 55%, but the rest of us, I don't actually know what the national average is for per week. I know that overall mode share is 1 or 2% for cycling, but I don't know like how many people
cycle
at least once a week.
I think it's in low 20s. I think
I might have a link actually.
Yeah.
So in other words, it's at least twice as popular in Oxford.
Definitely.
As it is sort of on average.
People just sort of accept it, really, don't they? You know, it's like that Oxford call themselves a cycling city, and that's sort of like
Philip Pullman.
Oh, he doesn't like it.
He doesn't like it much, does he?
No,
he lives
doesn't
in Oxford,
like,
doesn't like
it.
He somehow thinks that people who cycle without bike lights are an affront to him.
Yeah.
Ah,
I mean, ideally, have bike lights.
Yeah.
Like, that's like in the top 100 things that you could be annoyed about. It annoys me because I was forced to read Philip Pullman books growing up.
Yeah.
They were almost on the curriculum.
Yeah.
So I kind of, you know, I feel like, you know, that's a slight on me, actually.
But I mean, it is just one of those things that grates, doesn't it? Grates with the cycling community, a bit like Grant Shapps, he's the Transport Secretary, his announcement the other day that they're going to draft legislation to change the terms in which you can prosecute a cyclist for causing a death.
Yeah.
You know, after that, that prosecution for wanton and reckless,
furious cycling.
So it needs updating. Does it? Don't know if it does, really, because that happened and that seemed appropriate.
Is it a use of our legislative time?
And that's the point, isn't it? Because, you know, the legislative time is like gold dust. Yeah. You know, there are really big things to be getting on with. And they chose to that instead.
More people are killed by cows than cyclists.
Which is literally just a thing that isn't a thing. Yeah. You know? And it's just, that's always the case, isn't it? Philip Pullman, look at all these riders without, they're really annoying me without their bike lights on. Well, kind of like that's a bit daft for them, but it's kind of up to them.
It's why
scientists don't go on anecdotal evidence, isn't it? It's just not reflective of, we notice what we want to notice. I mean,
so what's the figure, Laura?
I found the figures.
Stats, Laura.
So nationally, 11% of adults, this is 2019 figures, 11% of adults cycled at least once per week. But a small number, but 4% of local authorities had more than 20% of adults cycling at least once a week. Obviously, Oxford and Cambridge being the biggest ones of those.
Bristol, probably. Bristol's quite cycly, isn't it?
Yeah, perhaps. Mm. Isn't York quite nice for cycling? Exeter. Yeah.
So the uncomfortable truth here is that, you know, we'll talk about the low traffic neighbourhood stuff in due course, but actually, sort of the cycling infrastructure, you know, the stuff that we're, if I don't mind blowing my own trumpet, the stuff that we're building in Coventry and like these, you know, cycle lanes of the future, LTM 120 compliant, they look brilliant and they are brilliant, but here they've just sort of got some white lines
a little bit.
And
when we cycled from the train station to come and meet you at the athletics track, and there was that little filter at the lights for cyclists, wasn't there, where the queue of buses had been stopped at a red light.
Oh yeah,
but there was a green light for
cyclists, the little painted lane on the inside.
We had to advance kind of on the inside of three buses.
Yeah.
Very, and I'm going double decker,
and I went for it, and I'm kind of going, any minute now the buses are going to get
just
the green light, any minute now
the
buses are going to get the, and they're all going to start moving, and then it happens.
Yeah.
And then I thought, Laura's got stuck the wrong
just
side
as
of that,
I was behind
she?
The front wheel.
That felt a bit bodged and a bit patched on and a bit kind of not terribly safe, actually.
Yeah, even the conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom now that we have of like cycle lanes need to be protected, separated from traffic. Not in Oxford, they don't. They've got the highest modal share pretty much anywhere in the country. So I guess
we've seen one section of segregated when we went over that bridge on the canal just now, didn't we?
Yeah,
that had a
but that was
of
a two way cycle lane, and it looked like a one way cycle lane. It's so
there
narrow.
Was no one coming in the opposite direction. Also, you were shifting at that point. Actually, no, I was on the front, wasn't I?
Yeah, you were on the front. Yeah. No, it was beautiful. Suppress.
I did actually, I did witness a head-on collision in a lane not much wider than that, although it was supposed to be one way. And I know.
Well, on the embankment
they were both
of London,
because
the speed a lot of riders go is quite hairy,
fast.
Actually.
Yeah, it is.
Because the demand is high there, especially at peak times.
And overtaking. If you're overtaking, then you're kind of going...
You're overtaking.
Going into oncoming traffic.
It's
so people take
hairy,
risks.
Actually.
Yeah, it is hairy.
So what gives then, though? What is it? I think in my head I'm thinking... Well, if you can filter the motor traffic out of the city centre core, which, you know, Oxford have,
you
increase parking to a level that makes it really undesirable to drive. You make public transport and you prioritise public transport. It all sounds sort of super simple stuff. And then you filter the kind of suburbs, which they're starting to do when we visited the low traffic neighbourhoods.
Yeah.
And kind of you get to a point where you get to that critical mass of cycling. And then you sort of, is it that you don't really need cycle lanes? Like, I'm just because, you know, in Birmingham with 1% of trips by bike to come here and say, oh, your cycle lanes aren't very good, you know?
I think we still have the problem of kind of just attitudes towards cycling. So I think if you're going to be riding with sort of traffic, then it either needs to be very slow or you need very considerate drivers. And I don't think we have those. I think even if you just have one driver in a journey that you feel has put you at risk, that's enough to put a lot of people off, isn't it? I was talking to someone, actually. I stopped on my way into town yesterday, and there was a woman building her own pathway to her house and building a wall. And I was like, oh, good on you. Like, you're doing a good job. And we just got chatting because she's in a low traffic neighbourhood, and this road used to be, it's quite wide and it's a one-way street, and people used to absolutely fly along there in their cars, and it was actually quite frightening. She was talking about how, you know, she'd be standing outside talking to a neighbour, and if you just see one or two people, you'd always see one or two people, she says, in like 10-20 minutes, just absolutely flying down, and it's off, yeah. It's off-putting. So it really doesn't take much
to put people off.
Yeah, it's just that one experience, and you just think, well, that was a near miss, the next time might not be a near miss. So
yeah.
I've talked to people who've been put off cycling by just one experience, so yeah, I think it does need to happen as well, because 40% is really good, but
they could still do better, right?
Yeah, 40% once a week, I mean, it's like four times the national average, which is a lot, but the national average is very low. So
yeah, agree. So we explored the filtering. Ned, when we were just cycling here, you perked up and said you had some profound thoughts on low traffic neighbourhoods.
No, not really. I mean, as you will hear when we speak to Emily, a lot of the discussion is quite detailed. And you know, I felt a bit unqualified, to be honest, because there's a lot of procedural stuff that's very interesting to hear. So I kind of backed out of that discussion. But I did... There was a lot of when we. Well, maybe we should hear. Should we hear the little chat with Emily?
Oh, that's a good idea.
Let's set the scene.
Let's set the scene. So we went on this bike ride with Emily, who took us through her local area where she lives, and its series of low traffic neighbourhood filters. And there are bollards, and there are planters, and it was blissful. Genuinely, we were riding for about 20 minutes through these lovely little streets, and we barely saw a moving car.
Yeah,
we saw a number of little. The cyclists or kids, we saw bits and pieces of... It was just lovely. It was incredibly traffic-free, and that's the point.
Well, hello from East Oxford. We're in a place called The Kidneys, which is not as strange as it sounds. I'm told a former sort of waste ground that's now a bit of a park, which is nice.
You're not selling it, really, are you?
Well, no, I mean, it's great.
Use your power as a description. It's a podcast.
Oh, no, it's nice.
Your experience.
It's nice. So I'm not Laura Laker. I can't do these wonderful reports from out in the middle of nowhere.
We're standing underneath some trees. There's a lot of ivy. We've got some stinging nettles. We've got a lot of long grass. It looks like the kind of place that would be great for nature. And there's a kind of dirt path running through it. And we're on the edge of a historical low traffic neighbourhood, and we've seen all sorts of people cycling through, and kids and families, and people walking, and it's very pleasant. We're under the trees, there's birds singing, it's a sunny day.
Yeah,
and we're here with Emily Kerr, councillor
Emily Kerr. Yes, welcome, Emily.
Hello, you're the reason we
know where we are, and we managed to cycle along what's becoming a kind of cohesive network. So, Emily, give us a quick introduction: who you are, what you do, and why you're interested in active travel.
So my name's Emily Kerr. I was recently elected to the City Council back in May, and I'm very passionate about making things easier for local residents and people with children and people who need to commute safely on their bicycles and walking and via buses. Yeah, just making it easier for people to get around and safer. We're standing here next to a school, which previously it was dangerous for people to cycle to, and now it's a primary school. Most children cycle. It's great.
And did you expect this to be the life that you were leading? You're a new councillor, aren't you? A Green Party councillor. So how is it all been, because you were elected and then the low traffic neighbourhoods came?
Exactly. So I sort of knew what to expect if I was elected, and having just been elected and having the low traffic neighbourhoods in my area has definitely been quite a journey, because whilst most residents of the area are supportive, and you know, we did a pre-consultation, 60% of residents are supportive, it won't surprise you to learn that many people from outside, in fact a majority of people who live outside who responded to the consultation, are not supportive. So we've got like a whole range of views, and obviously one of the roles as a councillor is to listen to people and to understand if we can make tweaks to the scheme, if we can improve it. But yeah, we've definitely heard everything in the last couple of months. It's been pretty busy.
I saw George Monbiot got involved in the LTN debate. Obviously, this has been going on for some time. Yeah, it was quite interesting because he lives around here, doesn't he?
He does. He lives. Yeah,
I was talking about how great they are. And yeah,
I think a lot of people have been surprised by how great they are. So people that lived here who were kind of on the fence or who didn't fully understand it, you know, when it's suddenly come in and you people realizing that they can walk around safely, that they can sleep at night because there aren't cars speeding through. I think some of us were prepared and had done research and knew about LTNs from other locations, but a lot of residents didn't. And that's what's been really exciting for me, is people coming up to me and saying, oh, you know, I've switched my journey to cycling because it's easier and that's what you want me to do, isn't it? And like, actually, it's all right. I thought it would be difficult and it's okay. Or people saying, I've heard birds for the first time since lockdown, or I'm suddenly able to sleep, or my children, I love this one, my teenagers can visit their friends, like they're allowed to go and visit their friends on their own, which they weren't allowed to do before. That's amazing.
So Oxford strikes me as, well, it's a really interesting place, but it is like perfect, it's the perfect size of a city to kind of like encourage and actually attain a paradigm shift in people's attitudes towards active travel, because nothing's too far away, right?
Yeah.
But before we set off here, and we met at the athletics track where Roger Bannister broke the 4-minute mile, which I found quite exciting. It's very fast, by the way, 4 minutes for a mile. Well, we knew that, didn't we? Because it was on me. Anyway, I digress. We met there, and before you set us off, you showed us a little map that was really instructive. I'm glad you did that, actually, because so the area in which these LTNs have been instituted is primarily Victorian housing inside the Ring Road.
Yes.
But outside of the direct city centre, which is obviously historic and packed with colleges and all that sort of thing. So it's the donut kind of thing.
Yeah.
But tell me if I'm wrong here. This is my interpretation of what we've just seen. There are two arterial roads in particular that kind of like bisect this area.
In a triangle shape.
Yeah. In a cheese, to use a Trivial Pursuit, kind of a wedge.
Love it.
And that was riddled with traffic, because when those ring roads sort of chogged up with traffic, people would use these streets to get from A to B, get across, nip across. So that was always the problem here. But that traffic itself wasn't necessarily parking up in these streets. That's not home, is it?
No.
And they weren't driving into the city centre to go to work. This is people from maybe outside of Oxford, from the outlying villages or even the smaller towns outside Oxford, perhaps, who were going in to do their shopping or go to work in Oxford Centre. So it's through traffic that was the problem.
Yeah, I think it's both. I mean, definitely some people used it to commute. People used it for local journeys, particularly because it feels quite unsafe. I mean, you've seen how narrow the streets were. A lot of people felt driving was easy for the small local errands. As we know, you know, one in four car journeys is less than a couple of miles, like that. There were definitely those kind of trips. Then there was people from real out of town being routed via Oxford to avoid the ring roads on a journey from, you know, north to south England. We've seen a lot of that. The sat navs would route people, and you know, we know well that sat navs have hugely increased through traffic in the last 10 years since they came in, and so we definitely saw a lot of that. And then, yeah, you know, there are some people that use the roads to commute to work. Sat navs would always direct you via the small roads. I mean, I used to use the sat nav myself, and I would often get routed via the small roads, and if you don't know any better, it kind of makes sense. You just follow what your sat nav says. So yes, I'd say there were all sorts of journeys that happened, but definitely a lot of people from out of town, a lot of people cutting through. Obviously it makes it easier on the commute, all types of people.
Have you done traffic counts yet? Because one of the sort of new, you've got the historic LTN in this area, they were sort of dotted around this cheese wedge, and then you've got one that came in last year, and then you've got one that's appeared since you became councillor. Do you have sort of before and after on the roads around the outside?
Yes, so we do from the Cowley LTNs, which are the ones you just mentioned that were introduced in 2021. These ones we don't yet have the data. So with the Cowley LTNs, what we saw is that traffic on the peripheral roads increased by 3.1% initially in the first 6 months, and then in the second 6 months they were there, it was up by 1.5% relatively, and I think internally it's cut by about 60%. It's 50 to 60%. So you know, the numbers are huge. And I believe they're continuing to count, so hopefully we'll see in like the third 6 months what's happened if the boundary roads have gone back down to being flat.
But of course, the thing that is really important to mention, I think, is the do-nothing scenario does not mean that traffic won't increase, because as more people adopt electric vehicles, you know, the Department of Transport's own estimates say that road traffic could increase by 51% by 2050. So often these 1%, 2% increases are seen as, oh, well, you know, but if we do nothing, we're going to see those levels of increases as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, we've definitely seen a massive modal shift, as it's called, right? It's people shifting to cycling, you know, particularly with the schools. I know that there's sort of an extra 200 kids from the school, not this school, but the one in the Cowley LTNs, that are now commuting by bike because parents feel safer. There's a lot of people saying that they're shifting. And again, I can't remember the figures of how much walking and cycling was up, but I think it was about sort of 30, 40, 50%. It was that kind of number that we saw, the changes within the Cowley LTNs. Obviously, these LTNs, we're still waiting for the data back, hopefully, you know, towards the end of the year.
One thing that puzzles me slightly in that, you know, I visited Oxford with my family a kind of a month or so ago, and very clearly, most people wouldn't observe the stuff that I observe, because I'm going to go, oh, there's a traffic sign there, or that curb's quite a good radius. But most people would go, oh, I like Oxford because I can walk around everywhere and it feels calm and it's quiet and it's interesting, there's stuff to do. Now, if you live in Oxford, you've kind of become accustomed, I guess, to you know, the reason Oxford is cyclable, I think, controversially potentially, is not because it's got brilliant segregated cycleways everywhere, because some of the cycling infrastructure is actually not that good. But they have managed to filter through traffic. You've got lots of bus gates in the city centre, you've got the new zero emission zone, you've got the no motor vehicles through traffic restrictions and those kind of things. And parking's like 35 quid a day as well. And obviously that only affects visitors and not necessarily residents. But I just wonder, given that a lot of these low traffic neighbourhoods have been controversial, why people are so surprised by this? Because I think Oxford's a city that has sort of been trying to reduce car use for quite a long time. And it's sort of, yeah, the level of anger, I totally understand it actually for what it's worth. But I kind of feel like it's sort of the narrative that's been building for not just a couple of years since the pandemic, but for decades.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. I mean, the areas that you're talking about in the city centre, I think people have not driven to the city centre for a long time unless they know they need to or unless they need to pick up shopping. It's tricky driving in central Oxford. It has been for a while. And there's, as you say, all the colleges are there, all the students on bikes. But I think it's introducing safe cycling or restricting traffic in very residential zones that's the new thing for Oxford. As you talked about earlier, right, there's the city centre and we're kind of in the donutty residential bit. And actually, many people would drive within this bit for local errands, to do shopping or leisure. I mean, leisure is 30% of car trips, isn't it? You know, like, so people are very used to driving but not going through the city centre. But the city centre is pretty small. Like, you'll know if you've been there, it's like a square kilometre or something. I mean, that's the kind of the area that's currently got the bus gates in it. Yeah, and also it's only 12 hours, so you can still drive through it in the evening. So I think people are just surprised by being restricted from routes that they've got used to driving in the last 10, 20 years since sat-navs. It's definitely causing, you know, as I say, loads of people are hugely in favour. There's definitely a lot of people that are really opposed as well.
There's always a sort of tension between city councils and county councils in terms of who manages the roads. And we were talking earlier about changes that have happened around that. And one example I remember covering years ago was the Plain Roundabout, which was in 2015. It was one of the most, I think the second most dangerous junction in the country for collisions. And then there was 1.35 million Cycle City Ambition Fund money spent on improving it. Didn't actually really improve it. Still one of the most dangerous. And I think there was a great deal of frustration. What's kind of changed since then?
I mean, there was a tragic death at the Plain of Electra earlier this year. And, you know, I think all of us that cycle in Oxford are scared of or very cautious on the Plain. It is really dangerous. It's got a lot of through traffic cutting through there. It's got a school, the private school, that has a lot of cars coming there every morning and every evening in rush hour, and they come all the way around the roundabout. Construction traffic goes via the Plain. Like, it is a dangerous roundabout, and I rarely cycle it with my children. I get off and walk, right? It's, that is a huge problem. Having said that, the Oxfordshire County Council, so I'm City Council, is looking to consult shortly on bus gates, and one of those bus gates would be on Longwall Street, and that would massively reduce traffic at the Plain. So I think that's something that, you know, wait for the consultation, but would be installed next year, hopefully early next year, and then that will really be a game changer for safety at that roundabout.
And you were saying that it's kind of changed at county level in terms of what the county is willing to do for Oxford, and I don't know about the wider county.
Yeah, I mean, so I think the new administration, again, it's not my administration, it's an alliance between the Liberal Democrats, the Labour and the Green Party, the Fair Deal Alliance, and I think they're doing some amazing stuff, particularly in Oxford. I know about better as being Oxford City Council, but, you know, wider, they're introducing 20 mile an hour limits in Whitney, they're improving cycle parking, they're removing parking, they are improving, you know, links on roads, you know, resurfacing. And then on the city side, I think the city's doing some great stuff. They've just announced three kind of linking paths. So obviously the city don't control highways, as you said, but for example, there's a park analogous to where we're standing here, and the city has just resurfaced and made a proper bike lane alongside it. And it felt really unsafe previously, and now it's great and safe to cycle with my kids. And so they're doing a lot of work on the land that they control, i.e. not the highways, to make things safer. So yeah, so I'm really kind of optimistic about what's happening in Oxford, the future of active travel here.
Just so I can understand, is it like London, where the sort of transport body, i.e. the county, controls the highways, by which you mean the A roads?
No, I mean all roads.
All roads.
Controlled by the county, not the city.
Yes, exactly. So I've called it highways, but it means all roads.
All roads. So all of the LTNs, that was a county thing?
Absolutely, yeah. And in fact, there's a couple of sort of joint projects. So if you've been to central Oxford, we've got this amazing area, Broad Street, which is full of cars. And the county and the city have worked together to basically take those cars out. So as of September, what is one of the finest squares in probably Europe, with the Bodleian and the Radcliffe Camera nearby and just beautiful old colleges just in front of Balliol, that's going to have all the car parking taken out. And that's a joint city and county initiative, largely led by county, but with, you know, heavy city support. So there's a lot of working together on projects.
And that park that you talk, it's Broad Street, isn't it? Is it Broad Street?
The area that I'm talking about, the in front of the colleges, yeah?
Yes.
Yeah, Broad Street,
yeah,
exactly.
Cool. Sorry, I'll start getting at that. I just wanted to make sure I was talking about
yes,
the same
Yes, there
thing.
You are, yeah.
So Broad Street, I saw some amazing visualisations of what it would look like, and then when it came, what it looked like, it was brilliant, and it was all kind of that pop-up stuff during the
yes,
pandemic
exactly.
with planters, and nice to see they used actual real grass rather than artificial yeah. grass, which seems to be popular with these kind of things. So it's all great. And then I was a bit bemused because then they sort of took it out. And I guess the two-pronged question is, I've seen this in my local area, you know, and got a little bit of control over this now. But, you know, sometimes arbitrarily we take stuff out because the traffic regulation order comes to the end. And rather than actually like, oh, there's an opportunity to lock this change in now. And I guess the follow up is, how important do you think it's been during the pandemic? You know, people like seeing what's possible, or in this early phase when the new LTNs are installed, being able to actually try them and use them, obviously even being sceptical to start with, but then actually getting into it once you've seen that it's something that you might be able to make use of.
Yeah, I think it's super important. I mean, Broad Street's a great example, right? You're referencing last summer when it was converted to, half of it was converted to this kind of nice outdoor park. And that has got such a lot of support from people actually seeing what it can be like. The whole lot is being done permanently in September. So that's, you know, really exciting. And I think that definitely allowed people to see what could happen. And yeah, I mean, with the LTNs, there are just a lot of people that didn't understand it, just didn't get it, didn't get this. Well, they're like, well, there isn't a problem. I mean, people, you know, humans resist change, and it's hard to visualize stuff unless you know about it. So the idea of change isn't appealing. But then it's the people that come up to me and say, oh, well, you know, I didn't get it before, but now I've spoken to people that live there and they say their lives have changed and now I really support it. It definitely makes a huge difference. And I think the momentum created by the pandemic, right? Because, you know, we all suddenly lived in our local areas a lot more. And we were like, oh, gosh, isn't it nice that you can walk around without cars? You know, there's the classic Apple Yard study from the 70s that shows how much better life and community is when you don't have super high traffic neighbourhoods. Yeah. And you know, in these residential streets, I don't know what it is here, but it's 92% of people live in residential streets in London, right? And I assume it's pretty similar here. It's possibly even higher because, you know, the road we came along, the Iffley Road, as you saw, half of it doesn't have any housing on at all. And so you obviously, you just get a majority of people really realising how amazing it can be to see your neighbours. The one of the planters I showed you earlier, they have like Friday morning coffee at now the street. I think it's like 11 o'clock on a Friday or whatever. And they're still carrying on with that because they can suddenly stand in the street and know their neighbours in a way they couldn't previously.
Yeah, I enjoy seeing the planters, and I think we all did. Some of them are planted up and looked after. They're maybe slightly different to in London, where they're sort of planted by the council, but they're sort of planted by local people and watered by local people. Some of them are empty, some of them are full of flowers. And there was one, someone had made a little painted sign for it. What did it say?
That was the Howard Street Bollard.
Howard
so it's
Street
decorated
Bollard.
And
it's
it
so
has
sweet.
Like
little hand-painted
flags.
Signs.
Sometimes they have flags on it, and they put tea and biscuits there when it was sort of launched. So yeah. For truck car drivers that kind of came up and couldn't turn around, they had like a little table of tea and biscuits. But a lot of love.
Yeah, but you can also see the ones that have made people the most angry because they've been yeah. driven at, because you can drive over some of them. They're sort of they're bendy, so you can actually drive over them with your car. And some of them are all scuffed, and a couple of them have been cracked at the bottom.
It's been
and they just
planters
like
graffitied with the local council's email address written on it if you want to complain.
Oh really?
Yeah.
And one said bulky waste please remove.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I guess there's always going to be that problem, and I guess some people will come around, some people won't.
I mean, I think that kind of summarises the position, doesn't it? In that I've shown you today some sort of lovingly flowery, beautiful bollards that people love, and then there's some other ones that people really hate and feel really resentful about the fact that they can't cut through where they're used to cutting through. And you know, I do really understand that, and obviously it is particularly difficult for certain residents who might have particular needs or like need to get places very quickly. There's concern about emergency vehicle access, although as you've pointed out, our bollards are soft, so there isn't any concern about emergency vehicle access. They can drive over them. But yeah, I mean, yeah, two different viewpoints definitely.
Yeah. I guess just digging into the different viewpoints, objectively, because, you know, obviously here we're pro active travel and it's very easy, but to be objective, I think looking at where we are now with the birds singing and there's, you know, some nice houses and with, you know, leafy suburbs, so it's not, we're not that far from the city centre, but it's very much got a vibe that you would say, this is a nice place, I'd like to live here but might not be able to afford to live here, kind of thing. Now, people that live here have now access, they haven't always had, but have access to good quality cycling infrastructure. They have some cycle parking now as well, we've seen that kind of thing. And I guess looking at the map that you showed us of the low traffic neighbourhoods, there's the inside the ring road bit, and then there's the outside the ring road bit, and the outside of the ring road bit becomes a lot more deprived a lot more quickly, yes. A lot more car dependent potentially. So I just wonder how you might, obviously as a ward councillor that's not necessarily your job, but I guess how we as the collective kind of we would reach out to not only instill the benefits, explain the benefits to those people, but actually ensure they do get benefits. Because if there is going to be increase in boundary road traffic, which it doesn't look like there's actually a lot, but if there is, it's going to go, you know, further out, and they might not have the same choices. So the answer often is sometimes, well, those guys need low traffic neighbourhoods too, but that's not always an easy conversation to have. And obviously the council have chosen to prioritise this area first, which is nice, and not necessarily looked at what they can do in the other area, which is less well off.
I mean, I'd say actually the areas that we're talking about is probably Littlemore and Blackbird Leeds are kind of de facto low traffic neighbourhoods anyway, and actually have previously been made low traffic neighbourhoods where they weren't. So Rose Hill, there's a couple of cut throughs that have been filtered over the last 20 years.
Is that outside the ring road, the bit that we're...
So Blackbird Leeds and Littlemore are. Rose Hill's just inside the ring road. But a lot of those areas, which are more deprived than where we are currently, have the low traffic neighbourhoods. However, that doesn't to the fact that because they're further away, it does make them more car dependent. This area, actually, if you look in this ward, it's only 50% car ownership, so, and it's relatively mixed, it's relatively deprived. Obviously we're standing in the nature reserve bit of it, you know, which is glorious and very leafy and all that, but if across the whole LTN area it is quite mixed. But coming back to your question, which was how can we make things easier for people that live outside the new LTN areas, I think access to cycling is like absolutely crucial. I think e-bikes are a real game changer, particularly cheaper e-bikes. So for people that commute, you know, there's people that work at my school just here that commute in from those areas that we've just been talking about, and they were able to switch to e-bikes in the summer because we got them a loan. But that's not a long-term solution, right? That was a summer loan that we have this amazing charity called Wheels for All that lend e-bikes out to people. But how can we help people cycle on these new routes, because it's possible now to cycle safely from Blackbird Leeds into the city centre? How can we, you know, encourage people to go from that learning to cycle? Because not everybody can cycle, not everyone learned at school. I think it's like 88% of adults, right? But that's a lot of adults that can't cycle. But going from that stage through the confidence to understand how bikes work, how to buy a bike, how to maintain a bike, and then sort of finally moving up the slope to being able to use a cycle for transport, because a lot of people don't necessarily view cycling as transport, they view it as a leisure activity. And, you know, that's, I was able to help that work for a few people at my school, but like, how do we make that more systematic? How do we give more people access? How do we make it the easiest option? Because it's all going to be about ease and convenience. And very specifically in the LTNs that we've just referred to, the Cowley LTNs, I think we're looking, or the county is looking at making amendments, you know, and it may be that like we use ANPR on one of them, one of the routes that's kind of blocked, which would allow carers, disabled people, buses to go through. And I think sort of, just as you probably know, outside of London, the county recently has only just got powers to use cameras and wasn't legal before. And so I think seeing where those could help some of the very specific problems. So really like listening to residents, understanding what the blockers are, understanding where they need to get to and when, and what the problems are, will allow some flexing of the LTNs on a couple of routes that at the moment are physically blocked, but might be able to be open to some of the people worst impacted.
I guess sort of so-called softer measures, the encouraging people, giving people access, helping people learn to ride and all of that.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, you know, cycle to work scheme, making it available for people on a minimum wage, which it kind of isn't always at the
freelancers
moment.
Freelancers.
Yeah. 0 hours contracts.
People who are retired.
Yeah.
How do we make it more accessible for people? And e-bikes particularly, I mean, e-bikes are so expensive, you know, that Halfords now do one for £500, but like people don't have that, particularly in this current climate, you know.
It's quite timely actually, because you wrote a piece in The Guardian, didn't you, Laura, about bang the drum again for kind of e-bike subsidies as part of the article. And I think that's always worth mentioning, because, you know, in Paris, where my wife's sister lives and we go and see family there, you know, they've got a scheme by the local Parisian government that provide an e-bike to citizens for a 6-month fixed term loan for €30 a month, including all the maintenance, etc. €30 if you're low income, €40 I think is the standard price. And then after 6 months, even if you really like it, you've got to give it back. But they then give you a €500 credit towards buying your own.
Yeah, great.
And guess what? It really works. And, yeah. And the bikes that are given back then get put into the system again for new people and things like that. I think we're desperately missing something like that.
I think there is going to be something like that. There was a trial in Cornwall and then it was put out to national tender and Cycling UK won the tender to do it. But I don't know what's happened to the scheme. And I think I mentioned this in the article. It was awarded in May and then it's been paused and no one will say anything about what's happening, when it's been going to be restarted, but I think it will include long-term loans, but it can't come soon enough. And also access to work, so job seekers, that can be quite...
There's a difference, I guess, between a long-term loan, isn't there, and that people can go in and, you know, they have to have a stock of bikes, but then also being able to provide it at a huge scale with the same sort of subsidies that we saw for electric vehicles, for example. Yeah. That's a serious sort of treasury decision that would be a significant policy, but I think the evidence would show that it would be a pretty sensible thing to do. And there's this deep-rooted culture, actually, that e-bikes are some sort of, like, you know, middle-class plaything.
Yeah.
And actually, we need to get them seen and treated as genuine forms of long-distance and mid-distance transport. So that was great. Thanks, Emily. Lots of enthusiasm, lots of knowledge. I thought I was getting quite good at reading off stats, but you're much better than I am. And I thought the point that you put out on Twitter was really interesting today. The stat that you mentioned that, yeah, like 88% of people can ride bikes, and yes, there are people that can't, but also that's more of a percentage than people that can drive cars.
Yeah,
we always say, oh, well, what about those?
Absolutely. If you look at people that can drive cars, it's like 76% of white adults. It's 60% of Asian adults and it's 53% of black adults, right? Like the many fewer people from traditionally deprived backgrounds are able to have a driving license. Like it's astonishing. Yeah. You know, most people can cycle.
And people talk about, you know, hardworking, hard-pressed drivers, but actually if you're far more likely to own cars and own more cars, the wealthier you are. And the people at the bottom of the socioeconomic level are least likely and can't really afford cars, and especially now with prices going up. So yeah, it's quite often misquoted.
Well, we're going to go finish off our little ride, Emily, if that's okay. Put us somewhere where we can find out where we're going. We're going to head into the city centre to see what that's all about and try some of the other low traffic neighbourhoods and potentially some of the slightly patchy cycleways, if you don't mind me saying. But you know,
you're being very polite about this.
We'll go and do that, and yeah, thanks for joining us.
Brilliant, my pleasure.
And as a massive truck reverses down the street, it's a timely reminder that other logistical forms are available. So to find out a little bit more about what's happening in Oxford city centre and the wider cycling scene, I'm joined by Chris Benton, who's the founder and CEO of not this massive logistics firm in a big diesel van, but of Pedal and Post, which are a e-cargo delivery firm. They also use vans as well. And I had a quick chat with Chris to find out a little bit more about the scene of cycling more generally in Oxford City and beyond. So Chris, welcome. And the noise we just heard was the reversing beep of a 7.5-ton truck it wasn't. That was the perfect setup, really, because it, you know, the irony was is that this big monstrosity was sort of reversing into this quiet filtered street at the end. And now we're talking to you, who run a logistics company which is kind of the polar opposite of that. So Chris, just give us your name, title, and what you do and what your company does.
So I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Pedal and Post, based in Oxford, and we're like a cycle logistics business and specialise in delivering with cargo bikes, big e-trikes, and kind of going ultra low emission in cities for deliveries.
Great. Well, Chris, you seem like a good person to talk to about the scene of cycling in Oxford. We've been on a tour, haven't we, Laura?
We have. Yeah. I wonder how the infrastructure helps or hinders you compared with like other...
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say something very similar, really, and it comes from how does Oxford's sort of cycling ecosystem support or hinder your business? I don't know. And then I guess the bit that I've got in my head is being taught, probably, or the way of school of thought in the UK is that it's all about cycling infrastructure and you've got to have really good, high quality segregated lanes, which I believe to be absolutely true. But Oxford really hasn't got any, and you're doing much better than the region that I'm from and that want to, you know, emulate some of what you've got here. So just tell us a little bit about cycling in Oxford, what it's like on a day-to-day basis, and how I guess it enables your business to thrive, hopefully.
So for us at Pedal and Post, I'd say like our team's probably ridden over 1 million miles in Oxford city centre so far. And for us, we kind of sit as cycle couriers in that kind of, you know, super sort of experienced, professionally trained, you know, kind of area. So we're the kind of team that can sort of push back against poor driving. But I absolutely agree. We're called a cycling city, and I don't think we live up to that particularly. So I do take for granted that Oxford is a very beautiful city to ride bikes around, particularly in the hot weather and sunshine at the moment. But it distinctly lacks a lot of sort of cycle infrastructure. So we have a lot of painted lanes. We've tried to push back sort of quite hard on that because we know if we're going to be able to enable people to cycle from, you know, the ages of 8 to 80 and sort of cover the school runs with cargo bikes and kind of inspire to what's possible, it's got to be safe to do it. And I'd say a lot of our team will sort of, you know, we are paid to cycle, we're properly trained, you know, to be able to operate in the city, but we largely would cycle in spite of the poor infrastructure. Although we are seeing some really sort of substantial changes that we haven't seen in the decade that we've been going as a courier service. We're seeing segregated lanes via ones, you know, starting to go in on some arterial roads. We've got low traffic neighbourhoods that are being supported by County Council, and you can already see the changes. You know, you can see more people using bikes, you can see them using them for the school runs or going to the shops, and it's really cool to see. You can hopefully be a part of inspiring that.
So you say even, you know, Oxford's got kind of got a baseline of a cycling culture, let's just call it, but you're noticing a more recent shift. Maybe Oxford's rest on its laurels for a bit too long, and now there's an understanding that you need to do more. Is that right, do you think?
Yeah, I'd agree. And I think you're seeing a bit of a sea change at the moment. It tends to be one of those things where the more people who cycle, the safer it becomes, because you've got sort of slight safety in numbers. And we're finding, although there's local pushback against these kinds of schemes, we know the roads are going to grind to a halt, so we're going to have to do something to kind of tackle these sort of problems and become a multimodal city. And for us, the low-hanging fruit is delivery work, but actually showing people what cargo bikes can do and what they can achieve. And, you know, there's some really good projects coming up in Oxford to sort of, you know, hire and lease e-cargo bikes and a number of other sort of schemes that we're really hoping to our local businesses and residents will take advantage of.
What kind of stuff are you delivering? You do post, I seem to remember, hence your name, but you do other stuff as well?
Yeah, so we've done a whole range of stuff. The core of what we do is what's called last mile delivery, which is working with like big national parcel carriers. You know, the guys will load up the big e-trikes with about 100 parcels. It's the equivalent to a van. And then they'll go off and do all their deliveries through the day. So we probably do around 800 to 1,000 parcels a day at the moment with a team of sort of 22 staff now. But some of the more sort of intriguing and unique things we do is like we deliver chemotherapy medication for the NHS now. And they've seen sort of 50% improvements using cargo bikes to getting those meds from the point of production to the patients quicker. So they can hopefully see patients on time, there's no delays, and yeah, it's been a really successful project. So it's these kind of things that we're really excited to do.
And I guess to leave with our kind of final thoughts of this, I keep describing it as cycling culture. I think that's fair. We're sat outside a cafe called the Handlebar, and I think I went past a pub that was something to do with cycling just a few hours ago as well. But I know the answer isn't one thing, but where do you think it stems from, and what's the enabling factor that, you know, is it just, oh, there's lots of students, or oh, it's flat, oh, it's compact, you know? Yes, so I think those things are at play, but where do you think it comes from, and finally, where do you think it needs to go next to kind of probably not only retain its status but actually be a genuine cycling city?
It's interesting, there's going to be sort of lots of variability. I know for me, owning a car, living in a city like Oxford that has quite high living costs and rental costs, for me owning a car just doesn't make sense. I sit in the slightly younger bracket, although the grey hairs are starting to show, running a small business around the sort of 30 mark, where I still don't drive and I haven't needed to. So I think for a lot of sort of young people, it gives them the freedom to know that they don't necessarily have to wait for sort of public transport. They can just jump on their bikes and go. And I think that's being sort of cheap, fast, reliable, I think, are the kind of core things, and you just don't need a car in a city like this.
One more question. Do you have female delivery drivers? Delivery riders, I should say.
We do. So we're in quite a male-dominated industry, but I'd say about sort of 10-20% of our team are female. And we really try and inspire more people to apply. A lot of our applications are from male riders, but we really want to kind of see that kind of uptake, if you like. We want to kind of change those sort of industry norms a little bit, because there's a lot of people who really enjoy just cycling around the city and being paid to deliver parcels.
I think that's obviously a really valid question. The transport industry and logistics industry generally has that bias deep-rooted. But one thing I had noticed being around Oxford recently and observing is there seems to be real parity in the people cycling, you know, not from a delivery point of view, but just generally the general population, which is really, really encouraging to see. But it's clear that it's not the these things is an evolution, isn't it? We've got to continue to develop things, and I think it's really interesting to see a city like Oxford with high levels of cycling from a UK point of view now sort of looking what it's got to do next. So that's really, really positive. So thanks, Chris.
Absolute pleasure, and enjoy the rest of Oxford.
So the thing I thought that I didn't want to interrupt, because you guys were sort of, there was a lot of focus on cycling, quite rightly, in that discussion, you know, about getting people onto bikes. But my real takeaway from that bike ride, actually, was less what people were doing on bikes, more just the absence of cars.
Yeah.
You know, just people sitting in their houses, not absolutely plagued by cars, you know, revving up and down the streets outside them. So it's less about kind of active travel, actually. I know I shouldn't be saying this on an active travel podcast, but more about just the absolute liberation of getting cars off the streets in that sense. That's what I really took away from that. I thought it was real revelatory stuff. And then I was reminded of, in London, my only, and I think ages ago on the podcast, I spoke about this, the very controversial and now entirely removed series of LTNs in Ealing Council on not dissimilar Victorian residential roads, you know, sandwiched between a couple of radial aliens.
Yeah, it's very similar.
Very similar. And really quite extensive. So this is an extensive network in Oxford. This wasn't just one or two streets. This was dozens of streets, it struck me. And Ealing was similar. And I remember telling you that I had to hire a car once to pick someone up who lived the other side of it and get them to Heathrow Airport for an early morning flight. Mm. And it did drive me absolutely berserk because I could not figure out how to get round it all. And it did, like, as a driver, I went, oh, my God.
Your blood pressure goes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I was running late. And I thought, I can really see why. But then listening to this discussion today and having actually seen what that must be like for the residents, I thought, well, yes, it was incredibly infuriating. But I was cutting through their streets.
Mm.
I was literally doing that. I was that person who was cutting through streets that I don't have any stake in to get from A to B. And if I'd been routed along different roads, you know, securely without my sat-nav taking me up these, it would have been much better for all concerned.
Yeah.
So that's the point.
Yeah, I mean,
I was the problem. And it seems such a shame that Ealing Council haven't had the gumption to stick with it in the way that Oxford seemed to do.
Yeah, absolutely. True. I think the notion of driving along main roads, which is what they were sort of designed for. You know, if you were just going on your nose or going on an A to Z map, you'd go on the main roads.
Yeah.
And the fact that we've used these side streets as kind of pressure release valves, basically, and because Google Maps have sort of sent us up and down these roads, which weren't designed for this at all, seems really unfair.
And the great irony is, if you want to drive from London to Birmingham, you have to drive from London to Birmingham. You're not going to go, well, I'll just nip around the country roads. You go, I'll go on the M1. And then the M1 grinds to a halt because there's a great big traffic jam. Or there's literally a junction that's closed and they have an official diversion that takes you through all these villages, right? The kinds of people who live in these villages who are now absolutely overwhelmed with traffic trying to get round the M1, which is too congested, would be precisely the sort of people, I reckon, who would be objecting to a low-traffic neighbourhood, meaning they can't get from A to B, you know?
Yeah,
possible. It's like, but that's the principle, isn't it? Like, so villages that historically out in the countryside have campaigned to have hugely expensive bypasses built round them, that's all LTNs are.
Mm.
That's all LTNs are. They're saying, you know, we have our little village here. We don't like people hammering through it in cars. Can you not do it?
Yeah.
You people have to get from A to B, and your A to B has nothing to do with us. Can we have a bypass? And LTNs are just reminding traffic that they belong on the bypass. So it's kind of like, it's only really, after years of talking about it with you guys, the penny's only really just dropped with me what they're all about, actually.
And your behaviour probably would change. People don't drive certain routes because, you know, people would rarely drive into London anymore, or, you know, because they know it's difficult. And the whole side road rat running thing helps, like, it kind of bats that excuse out, doesn't it, really? It kind of makes you continue to drive because there's always this release valve, whereas actually what you should be saying is, I know that A road's going to be massively busy, I'm not going to drive in.
I've got to explore every alternative before I resort to driving.
Yeah, and it gives you alternatives,
yeah, it really draws the whole process out of behaviour change.
My street is very similar to that last street we stopped in, that long one where we stopped at the you know, and had a little bit of a chat. And it gets very congested as soon as the main roads around me are at all congested. Our street, which is half a mile long, blocks up with stationary traffic. Mm. It's quite irregular. And I just, like, I was so jealous of what they've got here in Oxford. I thought, if you could stop that, and it's literally been stopped in Oxford in these streets, that would be life-changing for the residents of my street.
Yeah.
Literally life-changing.
Yeah. And we don't talk a lot about noise pollution, which is a huge health, actually, a health disaster. I mean, it causes stress. Yeah. Blood pressure problems, diabetes, yeah, like early death. It's a massive problem we don't really talk about a lot. And it just having cars coming through at night, having drivers come through at night is really, really bad for us. So,
Would your neighbours go for it, Ned, do you think?
I don't know. Like many a London street, I suspect it would be quite a polarising issue because I think, you know, London streets are very diverse. In all sorts of ways, they're very diverse, and, you know, people of all sorts of different backgrounds and creeds and beliefs live side by side. So I don't know. It's a very good question, but I would like to think that, you know, if it were to be imposed as the first iteration of LTNs were,
yeah,
weren't called LTNs then you might get the odd letter written to the local paper, and then things would calm down, and you just go, well, that was a damn fine idea, you know. But I don't know whether anyone would have the political will to do that in my bar.
Yeah. But Emily was saying, you know, it's like every time this happens, there's always people who are worried and concerned, often with
change.
Good reason.
Yeah.
But then once you see it in, and this is why people like Jeanette Sadiq Khan, who was in charge of New York's transformation and all of the pedestrianisation of Times Square and everything, talked about trials, because it's so important for people to see it for themselves, because we believe the evidence of our eyes.
Yeah.
And that vehicle's backing very close to my
There's a massive
bike.
Mercedes van reversing very close to Laura's bike, so she's...
He has a look of concentration on his face. That's good.
Got past it, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, it's just really important to be able to see things and understand how it works, because stats and facts are all very well, but actually to be able to experience it for ourselves and see, actually, this has made a big difference to people's lives, my life, my neighbours' lives, and suddenly people can come out on the street and kids can cycle, and it just feels so much better.
When I took councillors from Coventry to Waltham Forest, I mean that just did. You know, you can talk about it in emails and you can have meetings and webinars and stuff like that, but actually just experiencing it and just taking some... We weren't even on bikes, we were just walking down the street, and they're like, you know, all the cliched stuff, but, you know, I can hear the birds, and I'm, you know, I'm in a pretty busy part of London, and I'm walking in the middle of the road, and there's a nice little garden here, and all of these things. And straight away, people just sort of get it when they experience it. And it was interesting to hear Emily talk about the impact of the pandemic and the Broad Street kind of pop-up park and all of these things. I think once people get used to it and see this stuff and see what's possible, getting used to it becomes quicker once they can see it in advance, I think. And what we're seeing here is, because we've cycled through those streets that were filtered in the 70s and 80s as well, no one's shouting about those anymore, no one's complaining about those. And I think what we're talking about is is how long it takes to adapt to change. And it's like the same with me, like, you know, I drive a car still, like, not lots, but I drive a car, and if there's ever like roadworks somewhere that I wasn't expecting them, and I'm waiting there and it's adding like 5 minutes onto my journey, it will stress me out, and I'll be like, I can't wait till this goes back to the way things were. And my thought isn't like they need to do those roadworks, my thought is I need to get on with my life, please. But that's just an abnormal emotional response, isn't it? And it can't last forever, I don't think.
Yeah.
So that was Oxford, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Thumbs up for Oxford.
Should we do Cambridge next?
I could show you my old college, couldn't I?
Did you go to Cambridge? Of course you went to Cambridge, yes. Multi-award winning author. Of course you went to Cambridge.
Never won an award in my life, not unlikely to. All right, so that was our Oxford special. It's nice to be podding again. You've been listening to Streets Ahead. Our editor has been, once again, Claire Mansell. Let us know what you think at Pod Streets Ahead. Rate us, review us, and do all the usual things, and send us lots of love. And we'll see you next time.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.